Everyone, welcome to the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services. It is Tuesday, February 4th, and we want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1523.
No.
26. I'm sorry, 1526. Senator Steiner Hayward.
And what a call of Deborah.
And Deborah Rumsey. Is there anyone else?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 1526 is pretty straightforward. In the past, prior to the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, there was a program called FEAP, the Federal Health Insurance Access Program. Under this program, families that couldn't afford health insurance and didn't have access to it but also were not eligible for Medicaid had an opportunity to receive help from the federal government getting health insurance. And under that program, there were two ways that they could go about it. Either they could be on Medicaid at federal expense, or they could receive a subsidy to get commercial insurance. Currently, under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act and CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, everybody under 138% of the federal poverty level, adults and children, goes on to Oregon Health Plan, Medicaid. Adults up from 138% to 400% get subsidized commercial insurance. Children from 138% to 300% still stay on OHP, which results in families having adults on one form of commercial insurance and children on the Oregon Health Plan. Now, for some families, that may be a great choice. Their family doctor may take both, and they can keep their whole family together, and that may work really, really well for them. There may be things that their children needs that are benefits OHP provides, but the insurance that they could have, commercial insurance that they could afford, even with a further subsidy, couldn't provide. There are good reasons sometimes for that to work, and we want to make sure children have access to great health insurance. For other families, that may not be a great choice because it may mean splitting up the family, managing two different sets of benefits, following two different sets of rules about what's covered and what's not covered. So this bill requires OHA to go to ask CMS, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which oversees the Affordable Care Act, for a waiver to allow us to use CHIP dollars to help subsidize further the cost of commercial insurance for families between 138% and 300% of the federal poverty level so that they can bring their entire family onto commercial insurance if that's what's best for their family. It's a very straightforward bill. To the best of our knowledge, there's no opposition. It's about increasing family choice, improving access to different kinds of health care based on what a family determines to be best for their own needs, and we really urge your support. Thank you.
Your turn.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, I am Deborah Rumsey, Executive Director of the Children's Health Alliance. The Children's Health Alliance is an association of over 100 primary care pediatricians across five counties in the Portland, Vancouver, and Salem metropolitan areas. The Alliance was established in 1998 to promote a culture of improvement among member practices with a mission to improve care for all children. We are here today in support of Senate Bill 1526, and as Senator Hayward explained, it requires the Oregon Health Authority to request federal approval to use Children's Health Insurance Program's funds to subsidize the cost of commercial health insurance coverage for children with family incomes from 200 to 300% of federal poverty guidelines. We support Senate Bill 1526 for the following reason. Number one, patient choice. We believe that patients and their families should have the right to choose which health plans will best serve the needs of their child. When the eligibility level for the Oregon Health Plan was raised from 200 to 300% of the federal poverty guidelines, the patients lost their choice to choose a commercial insurance carrier with the subsidy that was mentioned earlier. Continuity of care. We believe that offering patients and their families the option to choose a commercial health plan will allow patients to maintain continuity of care with a current health care provider. This is especially important for those children who are managing chronic conditions, reliant on specialists, or have high support needs. Offering only one choice through the Oregon Health Plan may disrupt the continuity of care or their relationship with their medical home with whom the patient has established care and who understands the patient's unique needs. The third reason is because coverage of all of the needs for children and youth with special health care needs may not be served adequately through just one option of the Oregon Health Plan. For example, coverage for therapy services is subject to strict limits as to the number of visits available, and the prioritized list draws a line for covered services that may not consider the unique needs of children over adults. Another area of concern is the need for funded diagnosis to receive services. Kindergarten readiness and early intervention for children with developmental challenges is critical, yet the diagnosis code for developmental delay is not currently on the prioritized lists, making it difficult for children to receive the necessary services in a timely manner. In addition, newly eligible patients who have historically qualified for a subsidy through the Healthy Kids Connect program will be surprised to discover that certain routine services will no longer be covered for their child under the Oregon Health Plan. The Oregon Health Plan limits coverage for many of those common needs of children that could significantly impact the quality of life for these children, including rehabilitation for common sports injuries, common skin disorders, allergies, and behavioral struggles, just to name a few. Please don't get me wrong. The Oregon Health Plan does a wonderful job of coverage. It does focus quite a bit on preventative services and many of those mental health services, and I'm very pleased that it offers what it does. Offering a choice to patients who fall between the 200 to 300% of the federal poverty guidelines of accepting the Oregon Health Plan or a subsidized commercial insurance product will ensure that the families can carefully consider the unique needs of their child and their medical conditions when choosing a health plan. If a choice is not offered, the families have limited ability to impact the health needs of their child, especially if they have needs that are not covered under the Oregon Health Plan. If you have any questions regarding my testimony or the perspective of the pediatricians that I represent, please do not hesitate to contact me for more information. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify and urge you to support Senate Bill 1526. Thank you for your time.
And Madam Chair, if I may, Ms. Rumsey mentioned the 200 to 300%. I had hoped that we would draft it at 138% to 300%. I've talked to other supporters, and they're supportive of that amendment. So should you, I hope, choose to schedule this for a work session, we will be offering that amendment in plenty of time to meet the time notice things. And I've already talked with Ms. Teely Serka about that, so she's aware and is working with us on that amendment. And as far as I know, there's no opposition to that either, to expanding the range.
Senator Cruz?
A matter of clarity. So we're talking about kids that are eligible for Medicaid. And so what you're asking the feds to do is use the same match rate they would be using in the Medicaid program. And we're talking the same match rate. So it's dollar for dollar.
As far as I know, yes.
I think we need to be clear on that. So.
Yeah. I can get clarification. We've got folks from OHA here.
Is that what we're looking at?
Why don't we?
not exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't you come to the dais and?
Well, that's kind of important.
It is. Well, I'll let Ms. Moore Peterson talk first.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Judy Moore Peterson. I'm the Director of Medical Assistance Programs with the Oregon Health Authority. The question is, it's the same match rate for providing the subsidies for the premiums. It is the same match rate. There may be limitations as to how much we would be able to cover on that premium assistance, on whether the premiums for the commercial insurance would be more or less the same rate that we pay per child on the Oregon Health Plan. We would need to look that over. That's part of what we would be doing in talking with the with CMS in getting the approval.
I guess a fundamental thing here is, I mean, these are all Medicaid eligible, so there's state dollars already there, and the question is, is this going to be an increase in state dollars in the program, or is it just a transfer from one program to another?
We would need to take a look at what the overall fiscal impact would be, of course, with any bill.
Okay.
We would do that.
That's kind of important.
The initial conversations, if I may, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, the initial conversations that we've had suggest that the primary fiscal would just come from implementing the system changes to allow that flexibility with the dollars. And because the vast majority of Medicaid patients currently are being funded by the federal government under our waiver and under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, it wouldn't have a huge impact, at least for the first several years.
So we're because there are, if I could, are these, but these kids aren't the new eligibles. They're already covered, right? Or
most of them, not all of them.
There are some new eligibles in here as well?
If you mean the new eligibles under the
Medicaid,
under the ACA, under the Medicaid expansion. The Medicaid expansion is for adults.
That's what I thought.
So there may be new children coming on.
Well, right,
but they would have been eligible anyway.
So we're talking.
I didn't speak clearly.
Okay, we're talking the historic match rate that we've always. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Anyone else? Any more comments? Any discussion here? Is there anyone else? This is all that we had to testify on this bill. Oh, all right.
Madam Chair, I know the dollars and cents are a ways and means thing, but it would be nice to have, and I think we can get some clarification on that before we move it. So.
Chair Melissa Anderson, members of the committee, Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters in support of the bill. I worked on this with Rocky King back when he was at Cover Oregon and Bruce Goldberg back when he was at the Oregon Health Authority. You may remember last session, both of them testified on House Bill 2091, which was the bill that moved the Healthy Kids Connect kids from that Healthy Kids Connect program to the Oregon Health Plan. And what both of them testified last session was that was the short-term strategy, was to move all these kids onto the Oregon Health Plan. But that was not the long-term plan. The long-term plan was to give all of these families choice. And that's what this bill does. This plan implements what both Bruce and Rocky testified about last time. And we know, as Senator Steiner Hayward mentioned, from the FEOP experience, that families like choice. Some of them will choose the Oregon Health Plan. Some will choose subsidized private insurance, and that's great. This is really just an effort to implement what the long-term goal was. And the timeline, if we can, if they apply for the waiver by summer, then CMS, if we're lucky, we'll get an answer, maybe approval by fall or late fall. Then it has to go in the queue at Cover Oregon to be programmed along with everything else that's in the queue. So I think if all things work really, really well, maybe by the enrollment in fall of 15, this would be available for families. That's best case scenario.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm just looking for a little clarity is all.
We'll get that for you, Senator. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on 1526 and open a public hearing on 1553. Sandy, do you need to bring us up to date while I call up Senator Dembro? And who do you want to be with you? Mary?
Did you connect with the representative?
Senator, it went to voicemail, so I'm not really sure if she'll get the message or not, but Representative Doherty may be joining the panel.
Let me just start it off.
Yeah, okay.
Senate Bill 1553, Madam Chair, members of the committee, directs the governor to appoint an Oregon public guardian and conservator in the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman to provide public guardian and conservator services for persons without relatives or friends willing or able to serve as such guardian or conservators. The bill also specifies some of the details of the position and establishes the partnership fund, and Senator Dembro will fill in the gaps.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the state senator for Senate District 23, Northeast and Southeast Portland, and it is with a great deal of pleasure that I bring this bill before you, because this is something that has been in the works for 4 years at least, and you know, that I've been working on for 4 years, and it's evolved, and I think it's evolved completely in a good way, and it meets a real need. Let me just take you back a few years. My first session in the legislature, I was on the Human Services Committee, and so in that capacity as a rookie, I found myself assigned to a task force on a subject I knew very little about, and that was the problem faced by people in need of guardianship, people for whom the courts had deemed that they needed a guardian to be able to oversee their life decisions and their financial decisions, but they had no means to be able, they had no means, no significant estate to be able to hire someone to deal with that situation. The task force at the time, I was the House person on it. Senator Morissette was the senator on the committee, and it was chaired by Judge Betsy Welch, who had just retired from many years with the circuit court focused on probate issues. Had a number of really good members. Somebody from, there was a district attorney, there were a couple of judges, a member of Disability Rights Oregon, and we came up with an initial proposal for creating a standalone Office of Public Guardianship for the state of Oregon. Now, this was 2009-2010, and then it was brought before the legislature in 2011. You all recall what our budgetary situation was like at the time and the likelihood of creating a new office at the time. Even though there is, a great need for these services, which you'll hear about. And so we did not move it forward in that session. The task force, though, was, reconfirmed. Its mission was reconfirmed with the request that it come back in 2013 with a proposal. At that point, I stepped off the task force, and Representative Doherty stepped on. Actually, somewhere in there, Senator Ronna Sanderson was on that task force and attending, and so fully understands the needs here. In 2013, in preparation for that, the task force decided that a good way to go, a way that really made a lot of sense, was to take the guardianship services and house them within the existing office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office, which, I know many of you are very familiar with the good work done by that, and the able leadership of our state ombudsman, Mary Yeager, who was also on the task force, by the way. And once we decided to go down that road, a lot of things fell into place to where that just made a lot of sense for a number of reasons. It brought the potential budget for this operation in, it brought it into much more reasonable territory. It got a very good hearing in the House Committee on Human Services, went down to Ways and Means, where it was received very favorably, and was at the top of the list of those bills that didn't quite get funded at the end of session. But there was a lot of interest, if there were funding for it, to go forward with that program. And so it, as we moved into the special session and started talking about the funds that could potentially become available through the savings as a result of the changes to the senior medical deduction program. I think most people, and we talked a lot about this at the time, felt that they would like to see those savings dedicated to senior programs and ideally to senior programs that really focused on, vulnerable and low-income seniors. And this program, for obvious reasons, rose to the top of that list. And it generated, in the interim, a great deal of support from a whole range of members of the advocacy community. And it was put up at the top of the list of requests that the coalition of seniors and persons with disabilities were proposing for the use of that special purpose appropriation. In preparing the bill for this session, a couple of changes were made, the most notable of which, there were two notable changes. One was that we decided to create a partnership fund. So what the bill proposes, as you'll see, is it creates a guardian and a deputy guardian within the Office of Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and then ultimately a second deputy guardian. And that's great. They will deliver, much-needed services. But there will still be many people, especially out in the more remote and rural parts of the state, where there is going to be a need to contract with local providers to do these services. And so the bill also calls for the creation of a partnership fund, which would allow that kind of partnership with the counties and with the providers that the counties use to deal with vulnerable persons in their areas. So that change was made. And a second was so the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program has an advisory commission, the Long-Term Care Advisory Commission, which does great work, has done great work for a number of years. What the bill does, and I should say they are very enthusiastic about this addition to the purview of the commission as well as the office, just made a lot of sense to them. What the bill calls for is having the governor add three persons to that commission who have special expertise and experience with guardianship so that they can really be resources within the commission as a whole. So we think that we've come up with a model that is affordable, that the annual cost for this will be under $1 million, which is really remarkably effective, as I think anybody who's looked at how this is being pursued in other states and the ability to provide these services to so many people. This is a very cost-effective way of doing it, but also I think really the right way to do it, through partnerships and in a way that really respects the independence of the individuals. Guardianship is always a last case resort. You don't want to go into that lightly, for people who need these services, they're incredibly vital. So what you're going to hear after me is some testimony from people who've worked directly in this area. Mary Yeager is going to answer any questions you might have about her office. Holly Berman.
We know that we don't have much more time,
yeah.
So I want to make sure we get the others. But I want you to address the Dash 2 amendments.
Yeah, the Dash 2 amendments clarify the partnership fund and the members, the staff members that are added to the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's office. Yeah. It's essentially a gut and stuff, I think.
Is it? Okay.
I believe so. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Great work. Thank you.
Great.
Yeah. Holly Berman, Mary Yeager, and Rick Bennett.
I'm Holly Berman. I'm the retired public guardian from Multnomah County. Think back to 1973 and where you were and what you were doing, if you were born.
I was over there.
Oh. No, you weren't.
At Willamette in 73?
Oh,
yes, I
thought you meant you were the other side of the building.
I was also in college. That year, a small group of citizens got through the statute allowing for a public guardian. The only county that was prepared to do it was Multnomah County. And this week, in 1974, the public guardian's office in Multnomah County opened with a part-time public guardian and a part-time clerical staff in a closet in the courthouse. Here we are 40 years later, and that program has, for most of the years, been the envy of the rest of the state, abuse investigators, advocates, the Bar Association, families in all those counties have wanted what Multnomah County had, and many have tried it. There have been so many task forces, so many groups of people advocating for this, including the recent group, the group formerly known as the Joint Interim Task Force on Public Guardian Conservatorship. And so I am the person they scraped up from that group today to tell you how important this is, what an exciting opportunity this is to finally be at the front door of really being able to offer this program to the rest of Oregon, not Multnomah County. This is the program for the rest of the state. You know that we want to make it work. We don't want to come back again. We appreciate everything you've done and all the, you know, everything that's taken to get to this point. We really feel like this is the program that we can make work, and so we're looking forward to getting an opportunity to try.
So. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Mary Yeager, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and it is our agency that would be the housing body for this incredible program. And I just wanted to assure you that, as the Senator said, both our advisory committee and our larger mission is willing to take this on. So thank you for considering the request.
Thank you. And just to... why would it be better to be in your agency rather than in the long-term housing? I think there was an idea floating out there that it not housing.
Human resources.
In the Department
housing and Community Services?
Human Services.
I'm not sure if it's Department of Community Services or what. But.
So, Senator Monders Anderson and co-chairs and committee members, I believe one of the places it was being considered to be housed was the Department of Human Services itself. And after much analysis, it was very clear there were way too many conflict of interest in that agency. As the committee looked at potential places for this new effort to be housed, one of the other considerations was the opportunity for the independence of the place that it would be housed, which is where the Ombudsman Program was sort of pitched to the top of the stack. No matter where we looked as a committee and with Judge Welch's incredible guidance, every place had some conflict potentials. And a number of factors being considered, including the independence part of our program, that's where that offer was made. Is that correct, Holly?
Great. Thank you.
You bet.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. Consideration or time, I'll keep my comments short. Public guardianship and issues related to that is something that AARP obviously has been involved in some time. We track this issue and are involved in various national discussions, and many of our state offices work on this issue as well. Senator Dembro mentioned the task force. The task force's work is something we've also followed very closely. We think this bill received considerable amount of work and is well thought out, and because of that, and because we know the importance of public guardianship, we support this bill. Also, Senator Dembro mentioned the funding aspect of this. I would just mention that the Campaign for Oregon Seniors and People with Disability, a coalition group of over two dozen organizations who advocate on behalf of seniors and people with disabilities, has brought forth a consensus proposal related to the use of the funds, that $26 million that are in a special purpose account, and the funding of the Public Guardianship Office is one of those priorities that we've all agreed to would be certainly good use of those funds. And so I'm happy to answer any other questions. But again, we do, AARP Oregon does support this legislation. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Rick, what account?
As a part of the revenue bill that was passed during the special session, $41 million in savings from the senior medical deduction were achieved.
Oh, that's right.
$15 million of that was allocated during the session for OPI and transportation.
Okay.
The remaining $26 million set aside for
how
this
could
session.
I forget?
Yeah.
Okay. And while I got you, Rick, you know, the place to house this, I think this is the appropriate place. Would you agree with that?
I agree. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I've seen no further people willing to testify on Senate Bill 1553. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1553 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 23. And Sandy, bring us up to date. And Christy Rail and Shane Jackson.
And Paul, are you on the phone?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks.
Great. And Paul Tudall is on the phone. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1523 requires self-insured plans offered by the Public Employees Benefit Board, the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, and the Oregon Health and Science University to provide coverage of applied behavioral analysis and treatment of children with pervasive developmental disorders. This has declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Great. Paul, do you want to go first, or is Shane going first?
Why don't I go first, Shane?
Yes. Shane Jackson, for the record.
Chair Monifanison, members of the committee, my name is Paul Turtle. I live in Northwest Portland in Senate District 18. I'm speaking to you today in several capacities as a father of two young boys with autism and as the Oregon State Policy Chair for Autism Speaks and as the organizer of an ad hoc group advocating for insurance coverage for treatment of autism. You know, last year, the legislature unanimously passed Senate Bill 365, which, was intended to require all health insurance plans subject to state regulation to do basically what you see before you. That is, follow certain procedures for approving and managing treatment of autism in a manner consistent with mental health parity. In crafting that, like I said, our intent was to apply that to all plans subject to state regulation, and the intent was to apply that to specifically to PEB and OEB. And in fact, the fiscal impact statement for that bill was based almost exclusively on the fiscal impact to the self-insured plans administered by PEB and OEB, since the commercial plans by PEB in particular through Kaiser were already complying voluntarily with the same coverage requirements. As we have worked forward in the subsequent months, we've uncovered a couple of things. Because of the way Senate Bill 365 was structured in the insurance code, the self-insured plans by PEB and OEB are completely exempt from the insurance code. So, although the intent was to apply this to PEB and OEB, they are in fact completely exempt. The other things that came up is the bill is really based largely around mental health parity. It establishes a sort of rapid approval mechanism for younger patients seeking a limited amount of care with a confirmed autism diagnosis, and then references Oregon's mental health parity statute for anyone older or seeking more comprehensive treatment. And as it happens, PEB is exempt from Oregon's mental health parity statute. We similarly have a problem with OHSU. We've had a number of cases of OHSU employees who've been seeking coverage for the same kind of therapy for autism, and OHSU actually has a plan exclusion declaring that they will not cover applied behavior analysis, quote, even if otherwise medically necessary, if it relates to a condition otherwise covered by the plan, or if recommended, referred, or provided by an in-network provider. In discussing this with the insurance commissioner, she has advised us that PEB has a clause in its contract voluntarily opting into Oregon's mental health parity statute, meaning that statute does apply. OHSU has no such clause and is therefore completely exempt from the state mental health parity statute. In one of the packets that I distributed on OLIFs, we have a statement from an amicus curiae brief from Disability Rights Oregon addressing the topic of exclusions of mental health benefits from mental health parity. It is perfectly legitimate and reasonable for an insurance company to exclude coverage or deny coverage for a mental health benefit under Oregon's mental health parity law if that treatment is not medically necessary for a particular patient or is in some way an experimental treatment. Those are perfectly legitimate things, and when an insurer does that, the consumer has a right to appeal to what's called external review to have it overturned. What OHSU has done in its plan is they have gone a step further, and they have put in a clause saying, even if this is medically necessary for you, even if this is a proven treatment, even if our own doctors prescribe it, you can't have it anyway. And that is a step that goes well beyond what Oregon's mental health parity statute would permit. So what we're asking in this bill is not just clarifying that Senate Bill, the old Senate Bill 365 applies to these self-insured plans as was intended, but also clarifying that Oregon's landmark mental health parity statute has to apply to PEB and OHSU's plan, which currently does not. I mentioned that PEB's plan currently has a clause in it stating that it complies with Oregon's mental health parity statute. That's a very welcome statement. In prior years, it did not. In 2012, for instance, it did not have such a clause. And in September of 2012, I went with a PEB member to meet with Providence, which is PEB's plan administrator, to discuss the denial of coverage. And during that hearing, we specifically discussed the applicability of Oregon's mental health parity statute to PEB. And Providence, acting as PEB's plan administrator, confirmed that it was exempt from Oregon's mental health parity statute, that we could not use arguments based on that statute, in our request, and they actively used PEB's exemption from mental health parity as part of the basis for their denial of coverage. So, really what we're asking is, fix an unintentional loophole in Senate Bill 365 and apply Oregon's mental health parity statute to public employees and OHSU employees the same way they would apply to any other insured regulated by the state insurance code. So I'll pass this along to Shane and Christy, and then if you have questions later, I'd be happy to discuss them. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Shane Jackson. I am the lobbyist for Autism Speaks, a national autism advocacy organization. I come to you today. We are talking about Senate Bill 1523. And what Paul just said, basically, he summed it up, was that we're just asking that these public self-insured plans be treated like any other plan that gets covered by the mental health parity law. We had instances at OHSU and before Providence became in conformity with Providence, where people were getting administrative denials for their treatment. And it's a very difficult thing when somebody gets an administrative denial because there's no recourse outside of the court of law for these people to get their treatment for their kids. If they were given medical denials for their services, we could have worked with that. We could have gone through the independent review organization, and our success rate is 95% through the through that process, and we probably could have gotten these children treatment. But because it was administrative denial, because based on contractual language, we were left with no recourse. We do applaud the recent change at OHSU, where they will conform to the mental health parity law and be providing ABA treatment as of the 1st of 2015. And that is a very positive step up at OHSU. We also applaud Providence for getting its policies in line and voluntarily conforming to the mental health parity laws that we have here right now. But we need a more durable policy. So we can't get these administrative denials anymore. If they are to be denied, we would prefer them to be on medical denials. And the way we can make sure we can guarantee that would be to pass this bill. A recent development is that we have been in communication with the governor's office and other people, and we would really like to have another sit down and go through the bill, identify certain clauses and phrases that might have been out of scope in their reach, and make sure that they do exactly what we intend them to do, and there's not anything unintended in our application of this bill if it passes. So what we'd really ask for is an ability to keep this bill alive, move it forward, and be able to sit down with the parties that have approached us that say that they have some very constructive input into this bill as of now. So that's where we are right now.
Okay, and just to let you know that amendments need to be done quickly. Next Thursday is the last day we can move bills out. And just to let you know that.
Madam Chair, appreciate that. I think with what we were talking about, I think we can do that. I think we, the scope of the changes that we're looking at are really quite small, and we could probably accomplish that within that time frame.
Any other questions for them? Okay, go ahead.
Hello, my name is Christy Real. Thank you, Senator Mons Anderson and the committee members. I've provided testimony to you in the past on SB 365 and regarding my daughter who has autism and self-injurious behavior. At that time, I was testifying about the amazing effectiveness of applied behavior analysis. We ended up, after much work, getting her out to Kennedy Krieger Institute, Johns Hopkins University for treatment. After treatment, her self-injury was reduced by 80%, which is their success rate. In 80% of cases, self-injury is reduced, or any problem behaviors that they treat are reduced by 80%. So she came back. Sorry, is it a little bit closer?
No, further away.
Okay. So I wanted to show you a picture of before and after care. So before, you can see that she's having to be wrapped up in a blanket. She doesn't want to hurt herself. She can't stop. That's the only way to keep from injury. The bottom picture is a friend of mine who is from Eugene, Oregon. You can see his self-injury was very significant also. He also has to be wrapped up in a blanket to even begin to keep safe, but he's still able to injure himself severely. I flew out with him and his mother on December 15th to get out to Kennedy Krieger Institute, Johns Hopkins, to receive treatment as well. He's already healed, as far as his facial injuries that you can see in those devastating pictures, but I wanted you to see the devastating impact of problem behaviors and autism. It's very difficult to see. Most people, when they see that, they don't contemplate that someone could do that to themselves. In fact, we've had reports of people seeing us from a distance and assuming that we were abusing our daughter because they couldn't contemplate that she was doing this to herself. So I just wanted you to be aware of the severity of the situation and the fact that unfortunately, applied behavior analysis was the only help for our daughter. And the same other family, who's from Eugene, had sought help through many universities, including OHSU and down in California, for help for their son. And ABA has been the last and only hope for them. So we really hope that you will understand the importance of ABA. Also, I wanted to put in here that my daughter, when she went out to Kennedy Krieger, was 15 years old. Alex, the boy in the picture, is 12 years old. He will turn 13 when he is there. So I want to really put that in your mind that it's successful for kids over the age of 12. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm from Salem, Oregon.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I have a brief follow-up comment to a Christy Reels statement, if I could.
Yes. Please.
Yeah, so thank you. I just wanted to add the little boy, the 12-year-old boy that she's talking about, is actually a PEB enrollee. He is a PEB member, and when his doctors at OHSU recommended his treatment at Johns Hopkins, it was denied by OHSU. And this was just in December. And when that happened, I got a call from Johns Hopkins asking if I could help out and assist with the insurance appeal, which I very happily did. And it took, about a week with, doctors from Johns Hopkins, doctors from OHSU, negotiating with the Providence PEPS plan administrator. Initially, they initially denied coverage for this boy because he is intellectually disabled. There is a clause in the PEB member handbook which excludes any mental health services related to developmental disability. Now, he was not being treated for his developmental disability. He was being treated for self-injurious behaviors and other codes. But because he had an intellectual disability, PEB denied all of his mental health care on that basis. Now, once we got into it, and we also had a number of attorneys involved, assisting and advising the family and preparing litigation in case that had proved necessary, we got the case refocused a little bit, and basically PEB ultimately issued a denial letter that made two points. It argued that the treatment was experimental and unproven, and then they argued that they had a contractual exclusion denying all such care regardless of whether it was experimental or not. They did, however, allow us to go to the external review process despite the contractual exclusion, which, as Shane mentioned, in virtually every case overturns spurious denials of ABA therapy as being investigational, and that was overturned. And once the investigational denial was overturned, essentially PEB made an exception to their contract and allowed the boy to get his coverage. But, this should never have happened. This child should never have been given a denial saying you can't have mental health care because you're intellectually disabled. That's wrong. That violates Oregon's mental health parity statute. It violates ORS 743A190, which explicitly prohibits denial of treatment on the basis of developmental disability. And that's a fundamental reason why we felt we had to push forward with this bill, because PEB is right now issuing such denials, and we really need to get that clarified. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Great. Now, I would like to put on the record an email from Dan Forbes, interim vice president from OHSU. Dear Chair and members of the committee, as Oregon's only public academic health center, OHSU is committed to engaging in scientific, evidence-based practices. OHSU consistently supports insurance coverage for Oregonians of those treatments that are evidence-based and scientifically sound. With respect to OHSU's own employee benefit plan, we regularly review employee benefits through an extensive process conducted by our Employee Benefit Council. OHSU was not involved in the drafting of Senate Bill 1523. However, OHSU's employee benefit plan already has been and will continue to be in full compliance with Oregon's Mental Health Parity Act and the Oregon's Children with Pervasive Developmental Disorders mandate. However, OHSU will begin including, and this is what's important, additionally, OHSU will begin including coverage of applied behavioral analysis treatment in 2015 consistent with the requirements set forth in Senate Bill 365, which was from 2013, for other self-insured public plans. Therefore, OHSU's benefit plan currently complies with all requirements contained in Senate Bill 1523, irrespective of whether it passes this session. And So that is a statement that is on OLIS, correct?
Correct.
Yeah. All right. And then I wanted to have Brian Niebert come up, who represents, who will speak for PEB and OEB.
Chair Monitz Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, Brian Niebert from the Oregon Health Authority, here to speak on behalf of PEB and OEB. I think the summary of Senate Bill 365 from last session has already been said. We view that as a clear mandate, both from language in the bill and from the very clear legislative intent that applies to both the PEB and OEB plans. We've been moving forward with the understanding that with the operative date of January 1st, 2015, that is a mandate that applies to us. We are ensuring that any necessary changes in either contract or the RFP are in place in order for us to meet that mandate. As Shane and Paul have both mentioned, PEB also does voluntarily comply with the Mental Health Parity Act. That's in our contract with our PEB contractors and administrators, and also in our member handbooks, which is information I'm more than happy to provide the committee if you would like. We see Senate Bill 1523 as a reaffirmation of work that we already do and are going to continue to do going forward. I hate to be redundant, but again, we would be neutral on the bill, but if the will of the committee was to continue this, we'd be happy to participate in conversations to make sure the language would meet expectations.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1523 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1569, and I know that Senator Edwards was supposed to be emailed 5 minutes ago, and he needs to come down to introduce the bill.
In the meantime, you want help? You want me to do something for you?
I just run everything together.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1569 requires Oregon Health Authority to establish and maintain a list of designated high-priority chemicals, pardon me, of concern for children's health used in children's products, requires the authority to post the list and information regarding health impacts associated with exposure to each chemical on OHA's website, requires OHA to periodically review and revise the list. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Madam Chair. I think also in the OLIS, you should have a dash two amendment that I believe the senator and the folks will be speaking to as well. And that's what I have.
Angela, do you want to come?
He's on his way.
Okay.
There he is. Good timing.
Yep.
We moved on.
Yeah.
Okay. He looks familiar. Have we seen him before?
Time or two.
You look like you're ready, Madam Chair.
We're ready. With bated breath.
All right. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm state senator in Eugene and Junction City. And we're bringing to you today, you know, I'm terrible with my bill numbers, but I believe it's Senate Bill 1569. Okay, so this is the Toxics Disclosure for Healthy Kids Act. And I wanted to cover very briefly a couple of things and then just tell you why this bill is important to me and give you my perspective on it. First of all, I will cover in a very abbreviated fashion what the bill does in its current form, and then I'll explain in an even more abbreviated fashion what the amendment, a proposed amendment by proponents of the bill, would do. And then finally, I'll wrap up by telling you why this is important to folks like me. The bill, in essence, brings, as it sits in front of you today in the drafted version, the bill brings under a disclosure requirement 19 toxic chemicals that are used when they're being used in children's products. So those 19, that list of 19 toxic chemicals is created by the overlap of two lists, one being Oregon DEQ's toxics focus list, which is an extensive list that was developed by the department as part of the department's toxics reduction strategy. And then secondly, the other list would be the state of Washington's chemicals of concern for children list. I'm not sure if I have the name of that list exactly correct, but it is a list of 60-some-odd chemicals. Both of those lists have numerous criteria applied to them. So, I mean, there are, you know, some 80,000 chemicals out there, but if you apply different criteria, you can narrow it down to these two particular lists. The overlap of those two lists results in this list of 19. So the bill requires disclosure, and then in 5 years, manufacturers would be required to develop alternatives or phase out the use of those toxic chemicals in children's products sold in Oregon. After me, I believe somebody will be coming up to testify next, and they'll be presenting an amendment that would change the current bill's form and make it essentially a disclosure only. But the disclosure would apply to a larger list. So we have a couple of alternatives, and I'll tell you a little bit about why I would be personally supportive of either of those alternatives. And that's essentially that, you know, as a parent, I understand what it is that other young parents experience today. You know, there's a lot of anxiety out there about how we, and I don't think that's anything new to our generation. But what is new is a knowledge that there is an increased incidence of neurological disorders, pervasive developmental disorders, early onset puberty, cancers, and these type of things. And as parents, we don't know what to do about it. We don't know exactly what it is that's causing these things. As the father of a 12-year-old with autism, I'm particularly sensitive to issues such as toxicity and how environmental toxicity, whether it's in the living environment or actually in something like a toy, how that toxicity could affect neurological development and the growth of children's and the growth and development of children's brains and neurological system. So there is a lot of scientific evidence and knowledge that it seems as though we are ignoring. And so it leaves parents like myself who are worried about these type of issues to go to Google. I mean, where else are we going to find out, you know, what it is that might be harming our children, that might put our children at risk? And then once we know, based upon, you know, either credible, because you can find credible science and evidence on the internet, and you can also find complete bunk science that is not credible. So, once we do our own research, then how are we to know what we ought to be protecting our kids from? What should be allowed into the home? What should not be allowed into the home? There is no regulatory framework, frankly, that addresses this issue. Yet we know that our children are experiencing higher rates of all sorts of developmental delays, developmental disorders, neurological disorders. We know this, and yet we have done very little, either at the federal level or at the state level to address it. So we bring forward Senate Bill 1569. It's not new to this legislature. It was bipartisan in its support in the House last legislative session. It didn't make it through the Senate. I hope that it will enjoy some bipartisan support this session in the Senate. And we're willing to work with people that may see the issue a little bit differently. That's why we're going to propose an amendment here shortly that might make it a little bit more palatable for some folks. But at the end of the day, to me, I just have to wonder why it is that we are punting on this issue year after year after year when we know that incidents of neurological and developmental disorders are up, and we know that these toxic chemicals put children at risk. It's time to stop punting on the issue, and it's time to start doing something about the issue. And when you look at what it means for a family, what it means for an individual that's affected in such irreversible ways, to me, this is very much an issue of conscience. And if we cannot step up to the plate and do something about it, I don't know what would compel us beyond scientific evidence. Opponents that I've spoken with have, and I understand where they're coming from, opponents have said, well, can you prove that this particular chemical in this particular amount in this particular product ever caused harm? And I will say that by and large, the answer is no. And that's the point of why we need the legislation. That is actually the point, because we have scientific evidence that says we know that these toxic chemicals create problems. And in order to be on the list in the first place, there has to be scientific evidence that says that it's cancer causing or disrupts the endocrine system or the neurological system, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there has to be that evidence, and yet we have continued to look past that. So I hope that this committee will consider this very seriously, because it is that evidence, and it is the fact that these are pervasive chemicals in the environment, the fact that they're bioaccumulative, and there's a whole list of criteria there that the chemicals have to be shown to accumulate in the tissue, in the body, to be on this list. So this is not a random and arbitrary list of chemicals that have scary sounding names, therefore they ought to be regulated. It's not that at all. It's based on science, it's based on evidence, and it is because they can be so pervasive in the environment, in things like children's toys, that they need to be brought at least to a minimum under disclosure, so that parents are dealing with actual real knowledge. I went credible knowledge, credible science. I went to last year, and I was buying some party favors for one of my kids' birthdays, and I went to a dollar store. I don't remember which one it was, so I don't want to impugn whichever particular store it was, but it was one of those stores where everything is under a dollar. And I was buying party favors, and they're wrapped in plastic wrap and stuff. And some of them I got home, and there were things like rubber teeth and stuff like that. And I opened the packages up, and the smell of toxicity was quite alarming. And not knowing what sort of chemicals were being off-gassed by the products, I decided, you know, I think that it's probably best that we not hand these out as party favors. And of course, my daughter was there, and she'd already opened up, and you know, some of the toys, and I'm trying to coax them out of her hands, and you know, and that's what just everyday parents deal with. We don't know, what it is that our children are safe from and what they are endangered by. But the scientists do know, and this bill would take us down that road of matching the scientific knowledge up with and getting that to parents so that we can start greater levels of protection to our kids. So that, Madam Chair, summarizes my general sentiments about why this bill is so important to me personally, and why I think we ought to move forward with this bill. I know that many of you have been have visited with opponents and proponents of the bill. I know that for some it's not an easy decision. For some of us it's a little bit easier decision because we live with the effects of neurological disorders in our daily lives, and it's something that we take very seriously. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Since we have so many on the list to testify, I think we'll just move on. Thank you, Senator Edwards. All right.
Thank you.
Carol Craigie and Angela Crowley-Cock. And might as well bring up Sherry Maelstrom, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Angela Crowley-Cook. I'm the Legislative Director at Oregon Environmental Council. The Oregon Environmental Council supports SB 1569. As you know, OEC has worked for three sessions on this legislation to protect children's health and spur green chemistry innovation in manufacturing. The bill has bipartisan sponsors and passed the House last year with a bipartisan vote of 39-21. However, while we continue to be confident that this bill as introduced is the best way to protect children's health, we acknowledge that not all legislators agree. We know that there is broader interest in adopting Washington's disclosure law and at least to start tracking where these chemicals occur most frequently before deciding next steps. And that's why, in the spirit of compromise, we support amending the bill with the -2 amendments that you have and moving forward with Washington's disclosure law. Washington's law passed in 2008 with 41 Republicans and 91 Democrats, a near unanimous vote, and with only 11 legislators opposing. There are two parts to the -2 amendments. The first part is that the Oregon Health Authority will publish the list of chemicals of concern, which will be identical to Washington's current list of 66 chemicals. And then the second part will be the manufacturers of children's products disclosing to the Oregon Health Authority when their products contain those chemicals. I'd like to quickly highlight four differences between the bill as introduced and the amendment. The first one is that Washington's law requires manufacturers of children's products only to disclose when these chemicals are used. The bill that passed last year, as we mentioned, also included a phase-out of those chemicals. The second difference is that Washington's list of chemicals of concern is 66 chemicals instead of the 19 proposed in the original bill. As Senator Edwards mentioned, the state of Washington went through an extensive scientific review to develop their list. They developed an initial list of 1,800 chemicals and then further narrowed that to 66 chemicals using the following criteria. The chemical has been found in human umbilical cord blood, breast milk, urine, or other bodily tissues or fluids. The chemical has been found, that's one criteria, and the chemical has been found in household dust, indoor air, drinking water, or elsewhere in the home, or the chemical is present in consumer products. So with those three criteria, the list was narrowed down to 66 chemicals. The third difference is that the Washington law requires that companies of all sizes disclose when these chemicals are used in their products. The original SB 1569 has a small business exemption, as does the Dash 2 amendments. That exemption is companies with gross sales of less than $5 million a year will be exempt. That allows larger companies to pave the way and create a space in the market for green chemistry. The last difference is that the Washington law allows the public to add and remove chemicals from the list by petition, and the original SB 1569 does not. Washington has reviews the submitted petitions and takes them into consideration when they're revising their list. There have been two successful times when the petition system has been used in Washington, one to add a chemical and one to take a chemical off the list. Since the petition system works so well in Washington, we've included it in the Dash 2 amendments. The Washington law is working, and you'll hear more about that from our next witness. But just as at a high level, in a six-month period in 2013, 78 manufacturers reported to Washington State more than 4,500 children's products containing these chemicals. Those manufacturers included well-known national entities such as Gymboree and Mattel. Products reported on included toys, bedding, clothing, personal care products, and tableware, the little plastic spoons, cups, and plates that kids use. So in conclusion, OEC urges you, the members of this committee, to support SB 1569 and the proposed amendment as a step forward towards reducing preventable exposures to toxic chemicals and improving the health of all Oregonians. Thank you very much.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carol Craigie. I work at Department of Ecology in Olympia, and it's my responsibility to implement the Children's Safe Products Act that Angela referred to that was passed in 2008. And I was asked to come down and talk a little bit about our experience, so I'm going to focus on three areas. I want to talk a little bit more about the petitions that we've received. Our Administrative Procedures Act, which is separate from the Children's Safe Products Act, does include a petition provision, and what we did was add to some of that that right that's already there. We added some criteria in the rulemaking that we did around the act so that manufacturers would provide us the right information so we could evaluate petitions. We have actually received three petitions, two from the American Chemistry Council and one from the Washington Toxics Coalition. We denied the first one, which was to remove vinyl chloride from the list. What happened was they did not provide information, new information that we had requested that would show that that chemical did not meet the criteria that the law established for what is a chemical of high concern for children. So that one was denied, and then we accepted the other two, removed a chemical called N-butanol, because they did demonstrate that there was new information available, and what if we had known then what we know now, we would not have included that chemical on the list. The same is true for a chemical flavor retardant whose name I can never remember, which is, I'll just say, it's called TDCPP, and it is a chlorinated Tris flame retardant. And we added that to the list because, again, the Toxics Coalition was able to demonstrate that there was new information that we didn't know at the time had been had come forward since we created the list. So the petition process does work, and we have moved forward there. We have not been challenged on the broader rule around how to implement the act. So that's petitions. I wanted to focus a little bit on behavior change that we've seen, what's happened out there with just disclosure, because our law does not go past disclosure. And I have anecdotal information. I don't really have any kind of a way to track who's changed, who has substituted a chemical of concern. But I do have this little tiny baby shoe. It's a little flip-flop. And we did some testing of our own and found that this brown part on the top is almost 40% phthalates. And when we talked to the company who manufactures that little shoe, they were in the process of changing out how they manufacture that little shoe. So it had that impact. We also, in our rules, established a level of what constitutes a contaminant present in a product. And the sort of prevailing wisdom had been about 1,000 parts per million, and our rules established 100 as the level. And when we talk with compliance folks from various companies, it's clear that they are paying attention to the 100 level. So it's sort of shifted things a little amongst many companies. And that's not a scientific survey, but it's just our sort of anecdotal information. And then I was also asked to comment a little bit on what it cost us to implement this act. We took a long time to develop the rules. We wanted to work closely with the industry, particularly because this was a new kind of thing for us to tackle and we didn't know how to do it. So we worked very closely with a large group of stakeholders and developed our rule. And it became clear that when we decided to focus on the supply chain rather than just the shoe, but the plastic that makes up this shoe, we would need to create a database for that, and we required manufacturers to report to us on that database online. And that it's been successful. We've had a total of 380 companies and about 50 chemicals report. And as Angela said, it's been phased in, so we are not all the way through all the people who have to report. We've had three rounds of reporting so far. Another one due this month. But the database that we created is the source code is something we can share. I think there'd have to be some agreement between our two states about how to figure out the security, and that's the limit of what I understand about what has to be done there. But the source code is something that our IT folks are very happy to talk with your IT folks about how to adapt it. And then just one last comment on what it costs to implement in terms of ongoing. We have one FTE who works with people all over the world as they try to figure out how to get into our system. And once they figure it out, it's pretty straightforward. So we do a lot of technical assistance, and then we do some compliance work. So happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Okay. Thank you very much for coming down, too.
Can I make one comment just on Carol's testimony? This is Angela Crowley-Cook again. Carol mentioned how there was extensive rulemaking in Washington, and part of that extensive rulemaking was creating that list of chemicals, which Oregon won't have to do since we'll be starting with Washington's list. I just want to put that in the record.
Thank you. I move this very innocent-looking little shoe. It looks like a two-year-old might like to suck on it, too. Chair Amanis Anderson and committee, please accept my gratitude and ability to testify today in support of Senate Bill 1569. My name is Sherry Malmstrom, and I am testifying on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. I've been a public health years nurse for 3 decades, and I work in Multnomah County and work in maternal child health. As a nurse, I believe this legislation is really just a common sense policy for Oregon's families and the patients that I work with. The nurses that I work with in Multnomah County provide care to some of the most vulnerable residents. We take care of pregnant women, women who've just had babies, their children, and their infants. Frequently, the people I see have nowhere else to turn, and they're struggling to make ends meet, especially in this difficult economy. They're likely to be in poor health and likely to have children at risk for poor developmental outcomes and less likely to know about the warnings around hazardous chemicals in children's products and toys. They don't have time to track down the latest data on product safety or do a Google search. Frequently, they use second or third or fourth hand items. Requiring phase out of certain chemicals would eventually increase the safety of these products that get handed down from family to family and sometimes generation to generation. Many of these chemicals we're discussing today can lead to serious health effects, including early puberty, heart disease, certain cancers, and reproductive disorders. According to the CDC, about half of Americans are now living with chronic diseases and conditions, which account for 70% of deaths and 75% of all U.S. healthcare costs. Reducing exposure to these chemicals contributing to chronic diseases will benefit the health of all Americans and the public, and that reduce costs in the healthcare system. As a matter of public health, the state should act to ensure that no Oregonian unknowingly purchases a product that contains potentially dangerous chemicals for their child or their family. This legislation allows consumers to make an informed choice about what they purchase for their family. As a public health nurse and a member of ONA, I support Senate Bill 1569. This is an important step toward reducing exposure to toxic chemicals and improving the health of all Oregonians. Long-term, this bill will help ensure patients have one less thing to worry about. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today. I appreciate your time and consideration, and again, encourage you to support this bill.
Thank you. Question? Thank you very much. Helen Anderson, Joel Neig, and Sandy Griffin. Please begin.
Okay. Chair Anderson and members of the Senate Healthcare and Human Services Committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Helen Anderson. I am the founder of Milky's, and I'm an Oregon business owner, a registered nurse, a mother, and I fully support SB 1569. My company, Milky's, I started in 2007. It's a global company. We're based in McMinnville, Oregon, and we manufacture patented products for moms that are nursing their babies. Milky's products are sold throughout Oregon, nationwide, and exported to 35 countries. Milky's is also approved by the USDA and is provided by Women, Infants, and Children, the federal program for low-income moms, also known as WIC, to support breastfeeding in their vulnerable population. As a registered nurse with a focus on lactation education, I design Milky's to support families with information and useful products that can help mothers reach their breastfeeding goals. Milky's cares about the safety of the materials that make up our products. Everything we make is free of chemicals of concern like BPA and phthalates. We've done rigorous testing to ensure zero chemical leaching. And I actually attached the results of our independent laboratory report by SGS Laboratories out of Indiana. The impact of testing on our bottom line was small. It was simple and only required 3 product samples, and it cost around $800. These product test results never expire. This is a one-time cost. Our material is FDA approved. However, many countries require a higher safety standard. For example, in order to export to Europe, Argentina, and Japan, we needed to provide our distributors the independent third-party lab results that were $800, showing our product did not contain BPA or toxic chemicals. The FDA safety standards are simply not high enough, and our international sellers required lab test results proving our products did not contain BPA. Babies can be exposed to toxic chemicals through their mother's milk and are especially vulnerable to the hazards of these exposures because they are still developing. There's no sense in allowing Oregon babies to be exposed to these chemicals when infants in other countries are protected from them. I also support SB 1569 because it would make a big difference to small businesses like ours, and we would be exempt, that have invested in developing safer products and avoiding hazardous chemicals. By requiring greater transparency in Oregon's marketplace and holding manufacturers responsible for phasing out hazardous chemicals of concern, this legislation will help other manufacturers to be good actors like Milky's. It's time to act to protect the next generation of Oregonians. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 1569. And I work now as a consultant also for other companies that are developing baby products. And one of my main concerns whenever I develop a new product is it doesn't contain BPA and phthalates because it won't be allowed in the international marketplace.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Committee, for the chance to speak here. My name is...
There you go.
Better? Thank Better. You. As you can tell, I don't come here very often. My name is Joel Nigg. I'm a professor at Oregon Health and Science University. I have a doctorate in clinical psychology, and I've had about 20 years of research experience doing full-time studies of the causes of neurodevelopmental conditions like ADHD and autism and other learning problems in children. I've grown interested over the years in the potential for gene-by-environment interaction in the cause of these conditions. We've begun to study epigenetic changes in relation to neurodevelopmental disorders in ADHD. And we've studied some toxins, particularly lead, which is not on the list, but it's an abject lesson for us in how these studies tend to go. And part of what's been disturbing to me and to many of my colleagues is the longer we study many of these chemicals, the worse the news gets. It's been very rare to start out with studies showing some harm or some risk and then later decide, oh, that was a mistake. It often goes the other direction. In our case of lead, we've had to lower the actionable level over and over again as we do more studies and find out that even lower levels are associated with harm to children. Our own studies of lead showed that ADHD was associated with even average background exposure that every child had. Every child we tested had enough lead in them. So this model of risk that lowers with time, that is lower than we thought, the more that we study it, that the harm is greater than we thought, is of concern as we get into more and more chemicals. And from a scientist's point of view, the challenge is that we're always playing catch-up. We're always studying the last chemical, and the next ones are already coming down the pike without knowledge about how much exposure there is or how widespread their use is. As for the chemicals on this list, I think the literature that I've studied on these it tells us several things that we can say. As has been mentioned, they are bioactive. They affect immune function, inflammatory function, synapse development, and so on. That gives them very plausible chance of having health risks. So we can say we want absolute proof, but we can also say, is there a very realistic possibility? Is it prudent to worry about these? And I would say that that's clearly the case. They can have epigenetic effects, and I think, as some of you probably are aware, epigenetic effects can carry across generations. So once we get into this, it's hard to back out of it again. We want to know going in what we're up against. The chemicals can leach out of products and be absorbed by skin inhalation or eating. We know this by looking at urine levels and blood levels in consumers that use different amounts of these products, so we can see that they're associated with use. And we also see some evidence in the literature already that even at very low exposure levels, which would be typical from use, that there is alterations in development. So the case for possible harm is quite worrisome. The value of doing something prudent is quite high. And and one of the big challenges we have is we can't track the amount of exposure because it's not disclosed. We don't know where they're being used or how often they're being used, so it's hard to study the effects. And you see this as a big limitation in the literature, that over and over articles will say we don't know how much use there actually is or how much exposure because there's no disclosure of the use in products. So I would support either version of this bill, the original version or the amended version. I would see it as a very prudent and minimal step to begin to track a risk that we need to know more about. Thank you for your time and allowing us to speak.
Thank you very much for coming down.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Giffen, and I'm the director for the Oregon Poison Center, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today on behalf of the Poison Center, as well as Oregon Health and Science University, to express our support of Senate Bill 1569, the Toxics Disclosure for Healthy Kids Act. Children learn about their environment through their senses, which means accidental exposure to toxic substances. So just as you saw the flip-flop that was presented, oftentimes it's that mom who found her child chewing on that that's going to call the poison center, and our challenge is what to do about that. Last year, the nurses and physicians of the Oregon Poison Center helped to care for over 18,000 children who were exposed to potential toxic substances in their environment. And while we have a great deal of knowledge about how to handle acute exposures to toxic products, we have extreme difficulty trying to identify, first of all, what the substance of some of these other products are and what the risk of chronic and many times repeated exposure to some of these particular substances. The most frequent substances of exposure for children are those things that are in their environment, and in most cases that means in their household. And we know that chemicals can be carcinogens and hormone disruptors, these known as chemicals of concern, as this bill talks about. They're found in our air, dust, water, and even in the human body. But infants and children are most vulnerable and at risk of lasting harm from these substances. So as our state agencies are working to try to reduce the incidence of toxic chemicals in our environment, the same toxics show up in consumer products, which has been described today, including those made specifically for children. Senate Bill 1569 would take an important first step in establishing an efficient system to identify, collect, and share information about toxics when they exist in children's products sold in Oregon. Specifically, it would create a science-based list of high-priority chemicals of concern, require manufacturers to disclose and notify public health officials when their product contains those substances, and would be a very important first step and would be helpful for the Poison Center staff to be able to understand better what kinds of substances are in these particular products that many moms and dads find their child chewing on or having gotten hold of in their environment. So thank you very much, and I encourage your support of this legislation.
Thank you so much mm-hmm. for coming and sharing.
Can I ask a quick question? Does any of you know the comment about the testing that Milky's did, which is super cool, and it's great that you're doing this stuff, that's not a required part of this bill. This is simply a notification. You guys have gone to the effort of doing the testing and doing the notification so that you're confident you have it, but the Dash 2 amendments don't actually require the testing under the current Washington law. Is that correct? Do you not know? Can I ask Ms. Crowley-Cook to come back up?
She would know.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't have that question until I heard the great testimony about the Milky's product, but now I want to make sure that we're not including that with these amendments.
Okay. Yeah. Angela, do you want to come up and answer that?
Thank you.
For the record, Angela Crowley-Cook, Oregon Environmental Council. Testing is not required in either the original bill or the Dash 2 amendments. OHA can do testing if they want to for enforcement purposes, but it's voluntary.
But it's not required of the manufacturers. They just have to report of their own volition.
That's right.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. All right. With that, Tim Shestick, Betsy Earls, and Jennifer Gibson and James Curry, all four. We only have three chairs, but those are the last people to testify.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tim Shestick. I'm with the American Chemistry Council. Our member companies certainly share the proponent's objective of ensuring that products are safe for their intended use. I believe it's part of our product stewardship responsibility to produce products that are safe for their intended use. We have submitted several written comments and other background materials detailing our opposition to the bill as it was drafted. I would like to touch on a couple of those and just kind of highlight where our concerns lie. I think it's safe to say that our opposition is based in a couple of areas. One, from a science policy and a scientific foundation level, and then secondly, on a more general public policy level. We believe the bill is based on a false presumption that the mere presence of an identified chemical in a product somehow automatically equates to that product is harmful. Assessing the safety of a chemical compound or how it may be used in a consumer product requires one to look not only at the potential hazard of a chemical, but also potential exposure. As I understand the amendment that's being proposed, this bill would simply result in a list of chemicals that are currently present in children's products. The way, in my brief review of the amendment, the reporting threshold is extremely low. In fact, there is no reporting threshold as far as I can tell. It's just a matter of the ability to detect that chemical in a product. So we kind of question whether this is what really result from the publication of this list would essentially include, would not include information about what this information means and perhaps more importantly what it doesn't mean. We would look to Washington State. There was some conversation earlier about that current law and the program up there. I would point out, and what wasn't discussed earlier, was that Washington State does go to the extent of posting a disclaimer, helping the public understand what that information, what it does, what it means, and what it doesn't mean. In fact, they go on to say that the presence of a chemical in a children's product does not necessarily mean that the product is harmful to human health or there's any violation of existing safety standards. The reporting trigger mechanisms in Washington State are not health-based values, and the data should not be used to determine the safety of an individual product. So without that kind of disclaimer and that kind of context, we feel publication of a list like this could lead to some misinformation that would not necessarily be a benefit to public health. I think, secondly, on a general policy level, I know my industry and a number of other industries certainly understand that there is a lack of confidence, if you will, by a number of folks in terms of the safety of chemicals and consumer products. Questions have been raised of why the federal system has not been updated since 1976. We certainly agree with that. We have been supportive of an effort in Congress, along with a number of other trade associations, labor groups, environmental groups, and others, in support of the Chemical Safety Improvement Act, a significant revamping of how chemicals are regulated in this country. A bill currently is pending in Congress that has support from both sides of the aisle, Senate Bill 1009. It would do several things. We've provided a handout in our written testimony that describes some of the elements of CSIA, but essentially would require U.S. EPA to conduct safety assessments on chemicals that are currently in commerce based solely on considerations of risk to human health and the environment, and gives EPA the ability to focus in on sensitive subpopulations such as children when they're doing these safety assessments. I think the reality is that it is very difficult when states like Oregon, Washington, California, Vermont, any pick a state, when there's different reporting thresholds, different reporting requirements, it becomes very difficult for manufacturers to comply with a patchwork of laws. So we would encourage you to consider looking at this Chemical Safety Improvement Act and encourage the Oregon legislature to urge its congressional delegation to support it. Appreciate the opportunity to make these comments. Thank you.
Just one comment on that. It's very hard for me to think that the existing Congress is going to be able to move anything significant. And that's why I really feel strongly that states have to come forward. And if there are enough states that have legislation like this, then maybe it would pressure the Congress to do something about it. Just a an aside, but thank you very much for your testimony.
I have a question.
Yes.
I'll ask, and then if it's easier if I wait for it. Two questions for Mr. Shestek. The first is, do you have a sense of how many manufacturers in Oregon would be affected were we to pass this bill who are not already affected by the Washington law?
Offhand, I do not. But
okay. It would be useful, because if almost all the manufacturers in Oregon are already basically complying, one could make an argument that this bill wasn't necessary anyway, but I do think that consistency across state lines is really important, especially because, as the chair pointed out, the chances of a national bill being passed anytime soon are slim, to be generous. And the second question is, were that disclaimer to be included, the one that's on the Washington site, would that take away a significant percentage of your concerns, bearing in mind, as the chair said, that I understand your concern about patchworks of laws, but this is our neighboring state. There are a lot of people who are already complying with that, and we do have to start to put some pressure, which is often how things happen nationally.
All right, Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, I certainly would agree that it's important to put this information in context, because I think you do a disservice if it's not included in any sort of regulation. I mean, for us, we're going to have to take a harder look at the amendments. I just saw them before committee started. So I think there are some number of discrepancies between what's being proposed in the amendment and what's currently in place in Washington State. So I will defer answering that fully until we get a better sense of that.
That's fine. Thank you very much. But I would look forward to your thoughts about both the number of people who'd be impacted who aren't currently impacted, and whether, you know, what it would take to make the amendment something that you could at least live with.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Jennifer Gibbons with the Toy Industry Association. The Toy Industry Association is a nonprofit trade association. We represent over 600 toy manufacturers, distributors, retailers throughout North America. If you or your child has a favorite toy that you can think of, there's a good chance that that is a product of one of our members. Safety is very important to our member companies. And, you know, we can appreciate the desire of the committee as well as the sponsors of the bill to protect children. And we do support appropriate and strong not only chemical regulation, but also product safety regulations for toys at the federal level. We are.
Hi, this is Jason.
Okay, we have three more to testify. Jason, if you can hold on. Or do you
Absolutely.
Need it?
Okay, sorry, thank you. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
We are unable, however, to support a unique state-by-state regulatory approach to chemicals, as it is both costly and complex, not only for states to implement, but for companies to comply with. And it is very challenging for companies who are operating in multiple states and in international markets to be able to comply with this state-by-state approach. And however well-intentioned the programs may be, there's no measurable increase in product safety. And as much as our members, you know, strive for the ultimate product safety and it's a high priority for us, they don't have unlimited resources, and they want to put their resources where they actually can see an increase in product safety, and unfortunately, these disclosure programs do not achieve that. I also would like to go back to the disclosure or the disclaimer that Mr. Shestek mentioned that's on the Washington State website. I think it's really important to note that this information is publicly available to both consumers and to the Oregon Health Authority via the Washington State database. However, they do make it very clear on their website that the information in their database should not be used to determine product safety. And I think that would be, you know, very confusing for Oregon consumers to be relying on a database for product safety when there's been no safety assessments done and the information that's provided is likely to be more confusing than providing of answers. I think it's also important for the committee to note that there is consumer choice in the marketplace. Previous speaker, you know, testified about her company and how they've, you know, chosen to avoid specific ingredients in their products. And there are, you know, other companies who avoid certain materials. That's all advertised to consumers. Consumers who are, you know, concerned about those things have choice when they go to the store to purchase products. So for all these reasons stated, we would ask that you oppose this legislation.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, I should have asked this before Mr. Shestek and Ms. Gibbons. Where are you from? What part of the United States are you?
I'm located in Sacramento.
Sacramento.
As am I, yes.
Sacramento. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Retail Council. I think that AOI and its retail members take very seriously both the responsibility and the privilege of providing children's products to our customers, and also they take very seriously the responsibility of providing safe products to those customers and their children. I want to point out that this bill, Senate Bill 1569, would require manufacturers, I think, to report on chemicals in children's products, but if the manufacturer doesn't have a presence in this country, then the bill moves the responsibility to the manufacturer of record, which will be, generally speaking, the person selling the product or the retailer. So that is what the retailer community's interest is in this bill, not necessarily from a manufacturing standpoint, but from a manufacturer of record standpoint. I could go through our objections to the base bill, but it looks like what we're talking about at this point is the Dash 2 amendments. So I'd like to just address the conversation about reporting and how the bill doesn't have anything to do with testing or any requirement to do with testing, only reporting. I'd like to point out to you that retailers generally work on a very slim margin, even the large companies, which the amendment would address, and that simply reporting is not a small burden for those members. It's not something that they just do or that they can just incorporate into their employees' work day already. It requires, with a number of states with different types of regulations, a number of employees to monitor and make sure that reporting is done accurately and on time to all different states. So we do understand that this bill is a reporting bill only, and it has several aspects. Well, the amendments had several aspects that are similar to Washington's. Having just seen it, I would like to have a chance to look at it a little bit more, but I do believe there are discrepancies between the bill that's proposed and the Washington law. And basically what that means for our members is different reporting in yet another state without necessarily a high return in terms of investment for our, or in terms of safety for our customers. And so we oppose the Dash 2 amendments and 1569 at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Earls, I'm just going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Shostak. Could you try to get me an estimate as to how many Oregon businesses would be affected were we to pass identical legislation to Washington's? Assuming that there are already, you know, there's so many. I mean, if you look at something like the Kroger chain of supermarkets or something like that, they're already complying. They may not be complying in Oregon per se, but they've got a lot of stores in Washington. So could you possibly try to get some information about how that would – I just need to get some ballpark about how many Oregon businesses who would be affected were we to pass this would not – are not already complying in Washington.
Madam Chair and Senator Steiner-Haywood, I would be happy to get that information for you, but what I would point out to you is if – what you end up with is a bill that exactly mirrors the Washington reporting law. You have the information already available to you in Washington State, and the amendment, I believe, speaks to the opportunity for the states to share that information. So if that's what we're talking about, I think what you come to is the question of, are you trying to make the manufacturer and the retailer report in order to report, or are you trying to find out the information? Because the information in that case would already be available from Washington.
If I may, Madam Chair, thank you. I appreciate your point, Ms. Earls. I think in some ways this circles back to Mr. Shostak's point, and I apologize for forgetting your name, the point that, you know, ultimately having a patchwork of laws is not a good thing, but as the Chair pointed out, one of the ways we're going to be able to push the feds into action is for many states to have it. And if we have consistency among states, then that at least gives a framework for the feds to follow. It may not be entirely consistent with the bill that Mr. Shostak referenced, but at least it's a starting point. I think the other thing is that we know from a public education perspective, just because something's a law in a neighboring state doesn't mean that Oregon consumers are aware of it and would know to access the Washington Department of Health's website to do this. So I appreciate your concerns, but I think there is value in, even if it's an identical law, there is value in passing it. I'm still not convinced, you know, I haven't read the Dash 2s in detail yet, and I'll be interested in everybody's perspective about where they match and where they don't match with Washington's law. But I think there is value in passing very, very similar legislation from state to state, in part to force the hand of the feds.
Well, and Madam Chair, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I hear you about that, but I first of all, I wouldn't I don't mean to imply that Oregon consumers should go to the Washington Department of Ecology website to find out what's in the products they're buying. It occurred to me that it was possible that if what we wanted was in the information in Oregon, the health authority could easily access that information and publish it themselves. The other thing I would just like to note is that passing a similar law in a number of different states will certainly make an impact on Congress, but I would ask you to keep in mind that that doesn't come without a burden for some businesses that will be helping, you know, basically to push that point through the law.
Understood. Thank you, Ms. Earls.
Okay. Thank you. We have James Curry and then Dr. John Pearson. And Representative Conger, do you want to wait until two more testify and then go forward?
Madam Chair, if I could jump the queue just a little bit, yeah, otherwise I'm going to have to drop off the line.
Yeah, why don't you you start right now then? Thank you.
Thank you very much. For the record, Jason Conger, representing House District 54. I am not generally biased towards additional regulation on businesses, both for the cost and the competitive, anti-competitive effect that regulation can have, as well as my perception that businesses generally are more than well-regulated in many instances. However, in this particular case, I feel very strongly that there's a lot more unknown information, or there's a lot more unknown than known information about how chemicals that are known to be harmful or could be harmful could impact especially young children. And part of my interest in this bill comes from experience, and I just thought I would share that, colleagues, with the members of the committee briefly. I had the experience as a parent when my daughter Madison was born. My wife Amy and I took her in for her, I think it was 9 months, well baby visit. We lived in Massachusetts where there's a lot of older houses, and there's quite an extensive amount of lead paint. So when we took her in, she had her blood test, and it came back with an extraordinarily high level of lead poisoning. And what we learned was that it was irreversible, that it had long-term health consequences, that, for example, her IQ was likely to be significantly lower. Her mental health was likely to be harmed. You know, she was likely to have behavioral problems as a result of this, as well as other problems with organs and development as she grew all the way through her life, which was possibly going to be significantly shorter than it would have been otherwise. And it kind of goes without saying that we had no idea that that was even a possibility, let alone that our daughter was being exposed to this lead dust. And it turned out that the test was wrong because it was a skin surface blood test, or a finger prick, because she was an infant, or, you know, very young. And so we took her back and had the intravenous test, and she didn't have lead poisoning, but she was being exposed to lead. So we obviously immediately moved out of the house that we were in, and, you know, never forgot that feeling of powerlessness, that feeling of, I don't really have the words to describe how I felt when you know, the medical staff and the public health folks sat us down and said, your daughter's life is not going to be anything like what you expected it to be. It was both frightening. It was, I don't know, the worst part was maybe that I felt a large degree of responsibility. You know, maybe I should have known. But the lead dust was completely invisible. It was odorless, colorless. We had really no way of knowing it existed until she got that test. I'm very thankful that we took her in and got that test. I'm thankful that we were able to catch it and get her and our two boys out of the house where the lead dust was just coming off of old paint through the new paint and accumulating on the floors and the windowsills and things. But it was a frightening experience and an eye-opener for me because it made me realize that as parents, we do our absolute dead-level best to protect our children from risks, but we don't, the things that are completely invisible and are not known, that are not familiar to us, can be risked and can, in this case, obviously, could have done permanent harm, significant permanent harm to my baby daughter. And we had no way of knowing that. So in this bill, you know, what interests me in it is that sense of we do have to rely to some extent on government and on businesses to take some additional, some extra measures to find out if these things that we know are in, to some extent, or we at least have reason to believe these chemicals are used in manufacturing processes and are probably present in many children's toys, but we don't know the quantity. We don't know whether or not there's a lot of toys that have, you know, the same chemical, for example. So children could be exposed multiple times because they're, you know, they have a teething ring and then they have a pacifier and they have a sippy cup and they're, you know, all these various small level exposures could actually add up to be something that could be harmful for kids. We don't really know that. And this bill, in my mind, is a step towards trying to discern whether or not we should be more concerned. And in the end, it's really about trying to protect against the things that parents can't because they don't have any way of knowing whether those chemicals are present in various children's products, and they don't have any way of protecting their kids against exposure to those things. So with that, I'll conclude. I'm happy to answer any questions, but just really appreciate you hearing this bill and appreciate the opportunity to explain my interest in it and my motivation to get it passed.
Thank you, Representative Conger. We really appreciate your testimony. And there's no comments, so you can sign off.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is James Curry. I'm here with the Northwest Food Processors Association in opposition to Senate Bill 1569. You'll notice in the exemption language, exemption section, some language that references food and food packaging regulated by FDA. And while we do appreciate that being in there, we're not sure that it does cover all food and food packaging. And the reason is when beef or poultry is introduced into a food product, it then comes under USDA inspection. And so however well-intentioned that exemption is, it's not clear at this point whether food packaging is included or not. But really a big issue here is the precedent-setting nature of state regulators covering this area. We are focused on federal reform, as you heard earlier about the Toxic Substance Control Act, TSCA reform, and Senate Bill 1009 at the federal level. We are working with the coalition to make sure that, we can provide some more transparency to consumers and a better evaluation process for those chemicals in the stream of commerce. But really, our concern is at the state level, do state regulators have the expertise and the resources to do a fair and comprehensive analysis? And of course, do different state laws create consumer confusion and interrupt, interstate commerce? And we would ask you to take a close look at that food packaging exemption. But really, our big concern is the precedent-setting nature, and there's really nothing to stop future legislatures from expanding to food packaging. So with that, I conclude my comments and ask you not to move the bill forward.
All right. Thank you.
Questions? Oh, thank you, Chair Senator Anderson and the members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is John Pearson, and I'm a retired pediatrician. I was head of the pediatric department at Kaiser Permanente for about 10 years, and I'm pleased to see that they have endorsed this legislation. I'm also a member of the Board of Directors of the Physicians for Social Responsibility and a past president of the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. Many of the health problems that pediatricians are seeing in increasing numbers have been linked with exposure to toxic chemicals. We are seeing increasing incidences of childhood obesity, early onset puberty, learning disabilities, earlier diagnosis of diabetes type 2, and many other chronic health problems. And again, many of these health problems have been linked to exposure to toxic chemicals. It greatly disturbs me that many chemicals known to be carcinogenic or hormone disrupting are found in products children use every day. From school supplies to toys to sunscreens formulated for kids. For example, many vinyl backpacks and lunchboxes contain phthalates, which have been linked to an array of developmental and reproductive health effects, and chemicals that release formaldehyde, which is linked with respiratory symptoms and cancer, are routinely added to children's shampoos, bubble baths, and soaps. Children should not be exposed to toxic chemicals. It's important to understand that these chemicals are much more potent in infants and children because given their body weight, for every kilogram of body weight, children breathe much more air and drink much more water than their adults. And so the dose effect is compounded considerably with children. In addition, children's natural behaviors, like the fact that they spend much time lower to the ground and toddlers put everything in their mouth, increases their exposure to any toxic substances in the environment. As a doctor, and especially as a pediatrician, I'm committed to protect children's health and their lives. I see toxic chemicals and products as a serious threat to children's normal development and even their lives. I think we can remove many of these threats by identifying and then not exposing our children to them. So as an example, we must ensure our children are playing with, wearing, and using the safest products on the market. I encourage you to pass Senate Bill 1569 or the amended version to help combat this problem. And by the way, I agree it may be better done at the federal level, but given the unlikeliness that that will happen, and there is no good reason why we should not, why we should delay. There's no good reason why we should delay doing this very modest start at the state level in Oregon. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Come in. Yeah. No.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I'm just curious if you could clarify for me or help me understand. Formaldehyde is one of the chemicals that's on the list. And formaldehyde is also found in infant vaccines. So is it a different formaldehyde, or why is it that we would want to have that on a chemical list for toxics, but then use it to inject in humans?
I don't think that it's injected into the kids as part of the vaccines. I think it's used in the process somewhere. Most of it has been removed from the process. I don't think we're exposing kids to formaldehyde through vaccines anymore.
So you think it's just in trace amounts?
I don't think it's there at all at the present time in the vaccines that are given.
When I was doing some research, it was listed as one of the essentially ingredients in multiple vaccines, and so that's why I asked the question.
It may be involved in the preparation or storage of the vaccines, but in the substances that are actually given, injected into the children, I don't believe it's a component.
Thank you.
So I don't think there's direct exposure to the formaldehyde.
Okay. What I would like, obviously I'm a proponent of the bill, but what I really would like from the proponents and the opponents of the bill, that we get any amendment discrepancies from the Washington model. And so if we could get that. Also, with the food packaging, I was a little confused about that testimony. Is that relevant in the amendment? And any other requests before we hear this bill again?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so very much, everyone, for testifying.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1569, and we meet again next Thursday.
This Thursday, at
3
well,
p.m.
It's next Thursday, too.
It's Thursday.
It's the next Thursday that we run into, we'll be here.
And so we're adjourned.